Thank you, John. Thank you, everyone. I think I have the worst slot. I do. I think it's not just because it's after lunch, which I do think in principle makes it the worst slot. But it's also following up on three fantastic presentations by three fantastic people. So that makes it particularly complicated. And you also have the issue of not everybody having returned from lunch.
But they will.
And which makes it even worse, because then they're walking in the middle of your presentation. So I think all told, I have the most difficult presentation. I also should disclose that Janet didn't say who the person was who sort of jumped into the fray. But it was for this hurdle that we came up short, that we had some trouble securing someone. We had some really tremendous people that we were trying to secure, and it didn't work out. And so the sort of debate became, and with the planners, is should we just drop it, or should one of us try to do it? And I volunteered, or I was recruited, which I was glad to do.
You were voted in.
You were voted in.
I was voted in. Better to be voted in than to be voted out. I'll tell a funny story, even though he's not here right now, about Nick Rapkin. When I worked as a consultant for about 7 years for a company that was developing arts education programs across the country, and we were working very closely with the MacArthur Foundation, not only in developing a citywide project for Palm Beach County, and he's back, so we'll hear this story, but also in what was the original plan that led to Chicago Arts Partnerships in Education. And getting towards the end of my tenure there, and we did a lot of work with foundations all across the country. And I was thinking that maybe I'd like to go and work for a foundation. And the first person I called was a very good colleague of Nick's, Ralph Hamilton, who ran the philanthropy down for Palm Beach County. The MacArthur family had property down there. I don't think they do anymore. So they gave grants in Palm Beach County, and we worked very closely with Ralph. And I talked to Ralph, well, what would be my next move? Maybe I should work for a foundation. And he said to me, no, I don't think you should. He said, I think you should be an executive director. And actually, I'd never thought about that before. It sounded so naive, but I'd never considered it. And then he said, but you know what I think you should do? You should call up Nick. And Nick probably won't remember this. We had a very short conversation. And I didn't work that closely with Nick. I mainly answered the phone when Nick called and handed him over to Mitchell Korn. But I did speak briefly with Nick about the same issue. Should I go work for a foundation? And Ralph had suggested I call you. And Nick also said not to work for a foundation. So I ended up not working for a foundation, working with foundations.
You're the last person to listen to.
It may be true. But you were both, you and Ralph were very persuasive. My hurdle is a design hurdle that I think in and of itself may not stand completely on its own. It connects to many, many different things that we've talked about today. I do think it is also a challenge to make this presentation and not revise it drastically listening to everything that's preceded it. But I do want to talk to you just sort of firsthand really about this particular hurdle, the design hurdle, the structural hurdle, standards. And I'll start talking about the story from a couple of vantage points. One is, we applied for an I-3 grant, the Center for Arts Education. It's very much connected to this particular issue of design, structures, standards, and what we came to believe as the incoherence of the standards. And what I titled this, when form doesn't follow function. And it's a very interesting tidbit that came out of a study that we were looking at from Los Angeles Unified School District. They had hired EMC Arts to help them with their 10-year plan to advance arts education. And the researcher who looked at elementary level arts education had found that the vast majority of instruction in the elementary schools of the Los Angeles Unified School District was in the arts integration model. And that the district itself had done tremendous work in creating frameworks around discipline-based learning delivered by almost exclusively in the design by art specialists. And so it's a very interesting thing that the vast majority of the instruction actually is in integration, not being delivered by certified arts teachers. And the structures that the district had spent an enormous amount of time on actually were incoherent. Didn't make sense, and it went further to basically remark about the difficulties of doing that work when there isn't a frame, any sort of official policy frame, any way of organizing understanding, but nevertheless it is. And this idea of things being there, and that I believe we should accept them, if they are there, we would have to be insane to believe that they're not. I've actually had conversations with school district officials who told me that they wouldn't recognize the integration of the arts in audits and other things like that for a whole series of reasons and didn't want to. But it's there. It is. The standards don't recognize teaching artists, really. The standards will be redone for the arts, as they have been redone for most subject areas, and I doubt that they will, that the concretization of the teaching artist will advance very much in the new standards to come in the next few years. But nevertheless, they're there, aren't they? The teaching artists are there. The integration of the arts is there. It's not going to go away. And so when I hear some of my colleagues from some of the professional teaching associations tell me, and it's rhetoric, of course, it's almost credo, that arts can only be taught in schools by certified arts teachers. And further to the fact, some of these organizations are out there actually trying to push legislation at the elementary levels that actually requires that the only one, actually on a legislative basis, that the only ones who could teach the arts in elementary schools in New York State, in this instance, are certified arts teachers. But the teaching artists are there, and the integration is there. And wouldn't it be better for us to recognize it and try to find a way of organizing it, understanding it, embracing it, and creating more progressive standards and ways of knowing and design. And that's sort of an interesting way of introducing this issue. I want to unpack this through two or three legs of the table. The first one was mentioned, I'm not going to read my presentation. I'm going to try not to read my presentation. I actually hate reading from notes. But let me talk a little bit about this first leg of a table, and it's the leg that was mentioned earlier, I believe it was by Nick. And it was the idea that we've had so many years of so many people in the school systems and districts across the country who have had the arts missing within their own training and development, in their own K-12 education, in their own pre-service training, in their own in-service training. These people are teachers, these people are administrators, these people sometimes are school district officials, these people are working at the state departments of education, they're working at the United States Department of Education. They are, in some instances, policy advisors to the president, to the governors, to the big city mayors, and all across the country. Ultimately, what it points to is a leg of the table, which we would have to call the table of hurdles. That leg of the table is the knowledge gap, and it's or the knowledge deficit, and it's substantial, and has substantial and long-term implications. On a parallel track, and I think it's wonderful and very interesting, but let's think about the ways in which the arts have changed, just really even within the last decade. The ways in which the dividing lines among the disciplines have blurred, especially for younger kids who may not make much of a distinction between fashion and music, or between video and music, or dance and video and music, and the kids who want to do it all and feel that they can. The styles that have changed, the opening up of a global arts to anyone with a computer, that is really something we could not have imagined 30 years ago in our wildest imagination. You know, for some of us old enough, actually I'm not old enough, but for some of us the opening up of the world to Elvis, no, I'm actually not, but there's not much I could say about that anymore, but the opening up of the world to Elvis on the Ed Sullivan Show caused tremendous earthquakes through the American society. And some people would say was a contributing factor even to McCarthyism. But this sea change in the ways in which the arts function on a community level through diversity, through ethnic arts, as the sort of polyglot of the nation has expanded and our reach globally, it has affected the arts in dramatic ways. And also, of course, think about technology and the creation of the arts. Think about things like GarageBand. Think about the idea of digital photography. When I was in high school, you had to have a photo lab in a school. You had to have an enlarger. You had to pay for the film. You had to send the film away or do it in the school. Now, you can get cheap cameras for kids in schools, and you can open up an entire school to photography almost immediately, and they can become photographers actually instantly. And I don't think there would be any photographers, and I know a few high-level photographers that wouldn't quibble with my calling these kids photographers. It is instant access. And so think about that. Think about also this issue. The ways in which the arts function in the schools compared to what they once were, and I'll tie this to the standards and design in a second, has changed so dramatically. It was 35 or 40 years ago primarily an arts teacher, and it was a discipline-based program, so it would be a choral program, a music program, an art program. Today, think about it, and I'll read from my paragraph because I think this is a good one. What was once a relatively simple way of defining and delivering arts instruction in school has become a virtual kaleidoscope. From traditional discipline-based instruction to arts integration to in-school and out-of-school time to youth development and community-based models, all are delivered by a flexible formula of certified arts teachers, classroom teachers, teaching artists, parent volunteers, online instruction, and more. This is less the case in suburban districts. Rural, I can't speak to in quite the same way. But I believe that what you're basically looking at right now, imagine you're an urban school principal and you're beginning to think about the arts for whatever reason. Maybe it's an initiative. Maybe it's a relatively new school and you're beginning to ask the question of how could the arts take hold? You take a look at the wide variety of possibilities in all of this. You look at the schedule, you look at in-school, out-of-school, you look at the availability of organizations on the outside who come with their own money. You look at what the district is saying, you look at what the standards are saying. You look at all these, you look at parents who want to come in and teach or who are already teaching this. Imagine you're that principal and you have to somehow or another factor in this tremendous kaleidoscope and put a design in place. And further to that fact, you're a principal who knows very little about this and receives very little practical support from the district in order to do this. The support you may receive from the district, and this will begin to bring us into the standards, is really what I had written about in this piece, and actually in our I-3 application, that you would have to travel back in time to really use the standards in many of these instances. It does, on the face of it, sound simple. Can't you just hire a goddamn music teacher and put a program in place? I have said it myself, asked the question. I have heard the question asked many times. It seems so simple, doesn't it? But when you begin to look at all these pieces, the world has changed. We might not be here having any of this conversation if the big city districts hired and put the money and put the emphasis long-term into ensuring that enough certified teachers were in place to teach to the standards. But the big city districts in the United States do not, with only exceptions that prove the rule. And they have not for so long that we are therefore having this conversation about the variety and ways in which this takes place. So that's in a way the answer. What I've said to people at the New York City DOE is that unless they're tilted towards the certified arts teacher. And you should know, I run an organization that's probably been the most outspoken advocate for certified arts teachers in New York City of any organization in the city, and I would deem the state as well. Because that still doesn't mean we can't have an open conversation. What I would say is that unless and until the requisite resources are provided by the district, therefore all these other factors are there. There will be teaching artists, there will be parent volunteers, there will be a wide range of activities, instruction, curriculum, design, no matter what the standards say, no matter what the law says. All right, let's take a look at the standards for a minute or two. The standards are interesting pieces too. Standards have basically, for the arts, have been in place roughly since around 1996. Most of them sort of date from 96 to maybe 99. I think Massachusetts came around 98. New York State is around 96. They were all part of Goals 2000. They were all part of what was then to be a national standards movement. And then the arts field jumping into the fray, worried that they would be left behind, and advocated and lobbied for there to be art standards. So you have these art standards, and they're in the four primary disciplines, and they're K through 12. And they're very good standards, as traditional standards go, with benchmark years at 4 and benchmark years at 8. But then let's put them up against the states that have actual seat time and instructional requirements. So you have this big arc, K through 12 art, K through 12 music, K through 12 dance, K through 12 theater. These big giant arcs. Then what do you have as an exit requirement or graduation requirement in most states, if they even have one for the arts? You have 1 year, 1 year, 1 credit, 2 units. So immediately, don't you see a problem? There's a design problem. They're saying you only need 1 year, but they have 4 full years in high school alone. And so if they have it at the middle school level, which many states don't have middle schools, we have it in New York State, So it's 1 year of middle school. So again, what happens is they're saying there are two credit-bearing years of instruction from 6 through 12. So you get, out of the 6 years of instruction, they're saying you really only have to have two. So immediately you run into this design piece. And then, as I said, throw in the integration piece, throw in all the variety of ways in which things are taking place, and then throw into the fact that in New York State, and there are other states like this, you have departments of education that are unwilling to be part of compliance. The commissioner of the New York State Department of Education told me they would get out of the compliance business because they feel that they cannot do it. We'll see how much they can be forced to comply. We'll see what legislative solutions can be applied to regulatory practice. But you basically start to take a look at this and you see the stuff doesn't add up. And you get to a point in your life where you'd like to do, you, as I said, you want to take, if it's real, we should deal with it. And we should begin to work with it. So I think that this was an important piece to sort of look at connected to all of these things. Because what it does is, it speaks in part to Justin's concern. What is the arts? Who teaches the arts? What is the role of the community in deciding? Especially when you know ultimately that these people in the schools, a lot of them just do what they want. Because even the places that have had the most significant compliance programs, like LA Unified School District during that the period, I can't remember, when Rich Burroughs was at the district. And I think for a while the New York City DOE had was trying to put a lot of compliance, but even then, take a look at where the compliance is. You get half the middle school students can't even get 1 year. So look, we work very hard at the organization that I run on trying to move the compliance issue forward on the legislative solutions. But at the same time, I think that we have to begin to look at new designs. We have to begin to bring all of this into the 21st century. And we have to recognize what exists and begin to work with it. And what I would go further, and this is part of what we said we would like to be able to do with our I-3 grant if we ever get it, which the chances are very slim. But we had hoped to be able to find, and there's many, many other parts to it than I'll describe now, but we had hoped to be able to come up with new ways of facilitating the decision-making at a school level from among all these wide options that are available to that school principal or that school leadership, however it's structured or distributed in that particular model. And that there should be ways to do this, and wouldn't it be lovely if there were standards that supported that? And I understand that this is not easy. The more fluid the standards are, standards don't generally work in very fluid ways. You're talking about an almost counterintuitive approach. But I would also argue maybe the arts have pushed us to that point of where we have to think in new ways about this. But we should have ways of knowing, ways of doing, ways of thinking that respect the community of learners in that school, help schools find their ways of creating standards that have some connection to meta-oriented type standards, and give the tools to the people in the schools to find their voice, find their vision, and be able to put that into a design that can drive something very special for that school, understanding that it will vary greatly from school to school. And the fact of the matter is, it already does. So, you know, that's a little bit of what I wanted to talk about. There were many things I wrote in the piece that I'm probably missing. But let me talk about the recommendations. The first draft I took of the recommendations, Janet wrote me one of her very nice but very devious notes that basically was, well, these are very general. You know, I guess if you wanted to, you know, have sort of provoke general discussion, that would be good. But maybe you'd want to do something a little bit more specific. So I said, okay, I'll take a look at something a little bit more specific. And some of them veer off the map a little bit from what this piece was about. These I do want to read. I think there should be investment in research that provides a better understanding of the variety of ways in which quality programs are delivered equitably within big city school districts and the implications for future policy and design. Again, we're talking about big city school districts as opposed to suburban school districts and small cities. Here one might envision an almost ethnographic approach to researching these approaches in schools and communities and to better understand them. And I can imagine some people would say, well, you know, if we have money to spend on, I wouldn't make that my first priority. But again, the fact of the matter is, we should know better what's going on. We need a better handle. If we're going to, we need information. And this is not just data, but how does it work? How does it feed a community? What are powerful visions of principles that vary in great ways, but still provide quality arts learning that may not be recognized through traditional standards or formally known official ways of recognizing these things? I think that there's something there. I think that things have changed and we're not hip to it, so to speak. Or not enough of us are hip to it. I think we need a further examination of how disparate approaches are and can be better coordinated in school districts, including in school, out of school time, extended day, and via online learning. And of course, there have been some very powerful projects. We've heard about Big Thought today, where we know about what's going on in Boston. I would also point to you, you have a resource here among your peers, your colleagues, that he's never going to tell you anything about this. But your friend Daniel Windham ran one of the first coordinated projects in Kansas City, the very first. And he probably has a wealth of knowledge that no one's ever thought to ask him about. So I would put him on the spot and say, you should probably talk to Daniel a little bit more about what it was like to really be a pioneer in that particular work. That was the Arts Partners Project in Kansas City Young Audiences. I think we need to invest in a deeper understanding of what quality arts integration looks like, how it is organized, measured, developed, and supported in order to reframe the very role and nature of arts integration within arts and education policy. This was also part of our I3 grant. We said we would actually develop draft standards for the integration of the arts. And more to that, we said we would like to create a bridge between arts and ELA, the ELA Common Core standards, as a very interesting sort of sidebar piece. And again, there's also, and I'm not pitching our, you know, we probably won't get it, so it's not that I'm pitching it, but these were things we started to look at, and this area really resonated with me on a number of levels. I think that, God, it's all research and development, what can I tell you? I think we should encourage research and development among grantees, stimulating work across discipline, types of educators, use of technology, et cetera. Arts education funders should steal a page from the incubator type funding that has been directed towards things like audience development and support for individual artists. You know, when you look at things like, I've seen Mellon invest in some, you know, sort of interesting arts incubation projects. It was stuff that EMC Arts was doing for them, and there have been these things come and go, but there's something interesting. It has an R&D feel. And I think that, I think that the arts education field has often been reluctant to take these things on in a formal way because you often tied up, your funding gets tied up in the provision of primary service, direct service, especially in difficult times. You know, you realize that that organization that you fund may be the only arts that takes place in that school. And so, of course, you would feel compelled to fund them and support them. However, these other issues as complementary, as holistic ways of looking at the work, I think need to be embraced. Support overall research and development in arts education, R&D, and that's basically the point I just made, including advanced work in teacher training, parent training, principal leadership development, arts and technology and assessment. I'll skip the one I just mentioned, I just said that next bullet. I think that a dialogue does need to be fostered among teaching artists, teacher and administrator unions, and lo and behold, charter management organizations. I think it's the first time I've ever written them into any presentation. I think it would be important, and this is part of a previous discussion, to identify organizations in your communities that are service-oriented and well-situated for this type of work. They may not be in the arts. They may be in another domain, another area. Ask yourself which organizations are about building communities and coalitions. Coalition building in particular, from someone who's been learning the hard way, because we're doing a lot of it at the Center for Arts Education, and it has not been easy. And I've been humbled 1,000 ways. I think that coalition building from the arts or art and arts education to the outer world is maybe the weakest area in the fields of arts and arts education. We have been so stymied by the conversations with ourselves. And there is something very powerful when you sit down with an Advocates for Children organization and begin to find a common conversation. And so I think that that's a terrible weak spot for the field. I would suggest that you invest in organizations that work with national and local arts education policy. The arts education field has been weak in the policy area, including analysis, agenda building, legislative and regulatory bill drafting, and credibility within the education reform field. Again, I know you're always weighing, are we going to fund this organization that's going to provide instruction in a school, or are we going to put the money into an organization that's going to take 3 years to learn how to do policy analysis? I got it. I understand. But still, This has been a field policy analysis in arts education. It's really come along on the federal basis, on the local level. It is coming along. But this is, you know, in a relatively young field, this has been the tiny little fraction of the sort of knowledge and capacity base of this field. And that's even understanding the state alliances. There's a lot more work to be done in developing the intellectual and other types of capacities within this field on that basis. I think that you should consider what might be learned from the sometimes hard-hitting, proactive approaches to school reform made by some of the nation's largest foundations, Gates, and how such an approach might be adapted to benefit arts education. I also understand when you have access to $76 billion, or whatever the number is after you roll in Warren Buffett's money, that creates an exceptional circumstance. But there still must be things to learn about a foundation that has become extremely aggressive in how they do their work in an explicit and implicit ways. Those guys are out there and finding all sorts of ways to get their issues out, you know, in the public eye, into policy. So I think there must be a page to steal from them. I think that you should support the building of the relationships between grant makers for education and grant makers in the arts. I think a more dynamic relationship between public education funders and arts education funders is critical. Fostering common ground, greater opportunities to share and learn, and the vehicles to distribute knowledge and support across both the arts and education. And I know that's why we're here today, but I have to underscore that. There's something odd about it. Because we've been doing more and more advocacy work, policy work, coalition building, parent training, we have the feeling that at the Center for Arts Education, we will make ourselves more appealing to public education funders when they begin to see the parent training. I can tell you, when we first applied to DEC, the Donors Education Collaborative, and we were projecting work that we would do for the first time, you know, we basically were told by them, you know, we really like your proposal, but we actually don't think an arts education organization could do this. You know, this is an interesting issue because it bumps up against the ways in which the arts are designed and structured, the boards of directors, the ways in which we raise money, the fears we have about speaking out, the desire we have to do good things in the arts field. But I do think there's something to be said about this convening and the continued convening and building of those relationships. Finally, the history of arts education has been studded with initiatives by major national foundations that wax and wane, often leading to instability. I understand you never want to develop a dependency. I understand this better than anyone else. We got 13 years of half of our funding coming from the Annenberg Foundation. So I know, I get this issue better than probably most people in the United States of America. And then yes, they finally, with Lenore Annenberg's death, they did pull out and we lost half of our funding. And we are dealing with it, albeit with great difficulty. I think that there's something about, you know, the GE fund coming and making a big splash and then disappearing off the map. I think there's something to be said, and I'm sorry, I won't mind my saying this, for the Ford Foundation pulling out, the Dana Foundation pulling out. Because Bill Sapphire dies, the Dana Foundation gets out of the teaching artist business. When they had become one of the single most important engines towards advancing work in teaching artists nationally, the death of Bill Sapphire means that thing disappears. I do believe it may be creating more issues than people think. It's not as simple as saying everyone should be nimble and be ready to be diverse in their funding portfolios. I think it needs to be considered. And what I suggested is that some point of view be established within Grantmakers for Arts and Grantmakers for Education. And I also understand that many of you don't control these issues. They're boards of directors. There may be sometimes people higher up the chain. But the issue's there. When I talk about the reality, we should be dealing with what's there. This issue is there. I think that the grantees in the nation feel this very strongly, and I think the arts education people in particular, when you look at a couple of these big arcs come and go and sort of blow things in and then blow things out. So that's it for me.
Very good. Yay, thank you.